It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an author tells us how narcissism, drugs, and trash talk shaped human civilization. First today, Planned Parenthood officials at the Appleton North Clinic announced that the site will close permanently. The site was one of three abortion clinics in the state, and its permanent closure means Madison and Milwaukee will be the only cities remaining in Wisconsin to offer abortions. Jesse O'Poyan is with us now to share the details. She's a state government reporter for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Why is Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin permanently closing this Appleton North Clinic?
Well, so they temporarily suspended providing abortions there in October 2015. That was supposed to just be a six-month shutdown due to some staffing issues. But since then, about a month after they suspended abortions there, there was an attack on a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. And after that, the nationwide organization asked the statewide arms to start looking at their clinics and see what kind of security measures were in place, try to make sure that staff and patients alike could be protected. And it was determined that the Appleton location didn't meet those sort of new, stricter protocols, and it would be sort of cost prohibitive to bring it up to line with those standards.
And in terms of the value of the clinic versus the amount of money it would take to make it safe, do we know what the differentials were?
Yeah, the clinic, that location is assessed at about $140,000, and it was going to cost about twice as much or even up to about $300,000 to upgrade it. And they sort of, it's against their policy to talk about what those specific upgrades would be in terms of, you know, the actual security measures, but it was going to be about $300,000 to do those those improvements.
And in 2012, looking back then again, the Appleton North Clinic was damaged by a homemade bomb. What happened then?
Yeah, that was a situation where a self-described pro-life activist from the Fox Valley area crashed or smashed through a window and threw in a homemade bomb into the clinic. It was during the time when the clinic was closed, so fortunately no one was hurt in that particular attack. And he was eventually sentenced to, I think it was an 11-year prison sentence. But, you know, they said it's not that there was any one specific threat to this clinic that led to the closure, but this clinic, like many others that provide abortions, is sort of subject to threats on a pretty regular basis.
Well, what will happen now to women who need or want abortion services in northern or central Wisconsin now that this clinic is closed?
Some of them could have to travel pretty long distances. It could be up to 200 or 300 miles for some of those women. It sort of depends on where they're located in the state. You know, obviously, women up sort of on the northwestern side may find it easier to go across the border to Minnesota, maybe the Twin Cities. There's a provider in Marquette, Michigan that provides services on a fairly limited basis through a Planned Parenthood clinic there. You know, you could also go across the border to Illinois. Otherwise, in terms of staying in Wisconsin, there's two Planned Parenthood clinics still open, one in Madison, one in Milwaukee, that provide abortions. And there's also Affiliated Medical Services in Milwaukee that also provides abortions. But Madison and Milwaukee are now the only cities in the state that do this.
We're talking with Jesse O'Poyan right now, state government reporter for the Capital Times, and we're talking about news today that the Planned Parenthood Clinic of Appleton North is one of three clinics to provide abortions in the state. Now we're down to two because that clinic in Appleton will be closing permanently. And Jesse, you talked to the conservative Christian group Wisconsin Family Action. How did they respond to this news?
Yeah, my question for them was whether they saw this as a victory for the pro-life movement, and their director, Julianne Appling, said she sees it not so much as a victory for the movement, but for women in general. They obviously are opposed to any organization that offers abortion. The counter that they offer is pregnancy resource centers or crisis pregnancy centers. Those are nonprofit organizations that try to encourage women to not have abortions. They promote abstinence rather than sort of the safe sex approach of Planned Parenthood. So she said closing the abortion providing facility in Appleton is a good thing.
And any reaction from the community, people in the community so far around Appleton?
Being down in Madison, haven't gotten a chance to talk to a whole lot of people up there, but I think the concern for anyone who's been using that clinic is the lack of abortion services now. But you should definitely note there are still clinics up there that offer the rest of the services that Planned Parenthood has, birth control, cancer screenings, STD screenings, and there is another clinic in Appleton that offers those services, as well as a few others in that part of the state.
And what did representatives from that clinic itself have to say about it?
They'll be moving to other clinics. Some of them will be working in the Madison and Milwaukee clinics. Some will be working in some of the other healthcare facilities around there. But the woman who's the head of the chapter of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Dr. Kathy Hartke, says closure is a significant loss for women in northern and central Wisconsin. She said she feels like women who are now going to have to travel such a long distance to get that kind of care are being let down.
And you mentioned that Madison and Milwaukee would be sort of the last two cities where abortions would be offered. Do you have a sense about the financial health and then the possibility of those continuing? Are they looking to be in good shape, or are they facing any sort of possible closure like Appleton?
It doesn't sound like they're going to be facing that challenge. I mean, it was a pretty stark difference between the kinds of facilities. The Appleton facility is an older building that hasn't been as easy to upgrade over the years. The Madison and Milwaukee ones have been a lot easier to maintain, and they just provide more abortions at those facilities to begin with. But there have been more closures of Planned Parenthood facilities that don't provide abortions for the last 5 years or so. This is going to be the sixth clinic to close, but just the first that did offer abortions.
And when you talked about why this Appleton clinic was closing, you talked about the cost of making the building safe for the clients and the staff there. Did you hear anything about whether reduced state funding had played a role in this?
Yeah, they said that in this particular case, it wasn't necessarily tied to anything that's been done by the legislature. It was more an issue of this particular facility just not being easy to bring up to code. But that doesn't mean that the two aren't sort of interrelated. And their government relations director talked about some of those measures that, frankly, have not necessarily led to the closure of this particular facility, but have led to the decisions to close other facilities over the years. Like I mentioned, five others before this Appleton facility closed, and that has been more of a result of the loss of funding.
So looking at the big picture now, what does the closure of this particular clinic mean to abortion rights and abortion access here in Wisconsin?
It restricts it. I mean, it restricts it fairly significantly. Women will have to travel longer distances. Planned Parenthood does offer financial assistance to women who need it, who do have to travel in these situations. But, you've got Madison and Milwaukee aren't all that far away from each other, and they're sort of concentrated in one area of the state. So it does make it more difficult for women to get an abortion if they're looking to obtain one legally.
And the news today is that this clinic is going to be permanently closed, but is there any possibility that it could reopen in the future?
I think that's the hope, and I don't know that there is anything near a plan for that, but Planned Parenthood is fairly dedicated to trying to improve access to abortion while, the legislature, at least while it's under Republican leadership, is fairly dedicated to trying to restrict that access. So, if it were a friendlier legislative climate for a group like Planned Parenthood, or if, for some reason the funding would be there to start reopening some of those facilities, I think that's something they would do.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Jesse Opoyan, state government reporter for the Capital Times, and she was with us there to talk about the news that Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin is permanently closing its Appleton North Clinic, one of three clinics to provide abortions in the state. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's easy to beat ourselves up over mistakes we've made and to dwell on our failures. But new research says that we'd benefit more from being kind to ourselves in the long run. We'll learn more later on. Right now, we're taking a look at the flip side of history. There are a lot of advances and inventions that we'd like to say have shaped human history, things like commercial farming, industrialization, and the internet. But our next guest says that human history has been heavily shaped by things that we're not so proud of. Our next guest looks at how things like trash talk and drugs and narcissism have shaped humankind. Robert Evans joins us now. He's the editorial manager of the humor site Cracked, and his new book is called A Brief History of Vice: How Bad Behavior Built Civilization. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Why'd you decide to write about vice?
I've always found myself drawn to a number of different vices and felt, I guess, appropriately guilty for them. But I'm kind of a nerd, so when I'm interested in something, I spend a lot of time reading it. And the more I read about things like alcohol, bad language, various narcotics that people have used throughout history, the more ways I found those things were actually critical to our development as a species. And I thought that was fascinating because it's a side of history that's not often acknowledged, but is there nonetheless.
And you started with humans' love of alcohol, and apparently there are more advantages there than it seems like at first glance. Why is alcohol something that helped build civilization?
Well, you know, alcohol is a big part of the reason why we're here in the first place. There's a scientific theory called the drunken monkey hypothesis, and that's not my nickname for it. If you look up the scientific study, that's the actual name of the piece, that essentially states that our ability to metabolize alcohol came about 10 million years ago. So this is before, you know, Homo sapiens, our pre-primate ancestors. And they sought out alcohol because when a fruit has started to ferment, it's reached its most calorically dense. And that means you're going to get the most, you know, total fat nutrition out of it, which was a benefit in the days when there wasn't a 7-Eleven on every street corner. So even at that point in time, you know, 10 million years before human beings were human beings, our ancestors were seeking out alcohol, and it was helping to keep them alive. And as we, you know, Homo sapiens came around, alcohol played a really critical role in the formulation of human civilization. There's a theory that's often cited that beer brewing is essentially what kickstarted civilization. And I talked to the author of that study, Dr. Brian Hayden. The study is called What Was Brewing in the Natufian? And one of the things he pointed out is that it's not just alcohol that was sort of responsible for the birth of agriculture. It was the desire to throw really good parties. Because back in the day, you know, when we're talking 12, 13, 14,000 BC, before people are living in cities, tribes, essentially their earliest method of international government was to get together and throw a big drunken feast. And that's where you'd air your grievances. You'd talk out, you know, what the land boundaries are going to be between different peoples. And it was also sort of a way for different groups to project power. Now we have aircraft carriers and planes to project power. But in, you know, ancient times, they could say, well, look at all this food we're able to provide. Look at all this beer we can brew. Right now we're content, you know, using all that to have a good time with you. But if you make us angry, if you cross us, we could use all this ingenuity and spare time to really wreck your day.
So it led to civilization there. And I always thought cooking with fire was something that helped human beings absorb nutrients and get big brains. Do you think this is on par with that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, you know, there's actually been research to show that when people...
Whoops, Robert, are you there?
...calories, and if they were to drink before eating or drink after eating, just the act of drinking while we're eating makes us want to eat more. And again, tens of thousands of years ago, millions of years ago, that's a good thing. Nowadays, it's more of a problem. But it's also just that, you know, you talk about fire. The first recipe that we have any record of in human history is a beer recipe. And it actually includes a recipe for bread, but the bread wasn't meant to be eaten at that point. The bread was meant to be used as the basis of the beer. And this isn't just because the ancients were drunk. It's because alcohol, for one thing, makes the water around you a lot safer. Generations of people survived because they were able to kill the bad things lurking in their local water by turning it into beer or wine. And another critical aspect of, you know, before economies are developed, before we're using currency in a lot of, and you saw this in Mesoamerica as well as in the Middle East, governments would pay their workers in beer. And the Mayan Empire, I think, was about a liter of beer a day. And that's how they built, like, civic projects were done. That's how you'd handle the government work.
We're talking with Robert Evans right now. He's the editorial manager at the humor site Cracked, and we're talking right now about his new book. It's called A Brief History of Vice, How Bad Behavior Built Civilization. Looking right now at things like alcohol, Robert gets into that, says it was a key aspect of what helped build civilization. And we're also going to take a look at some other things. Tobacco. That's another one. Also, trash talk. Why overconfidence? Why bragging? Why being sarcastic? Why all of those things may have helped keep us alive. And we're going to continue that conversation right now with Robert Evans. And Robert, you were talking about finding a super old recipe for beer. Did you try it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I brewed it up. It's actually the oldest recipe of any kind in history. I don't know if that part got out, but yeah, it's an ancient Sumerian recipe for beer that doubled as a religious prayer because the goddess of Ninkasi was literally the goddess of alcohol. And so that was part of, like, their religious observance, and it was also how the government would pay workers. So it was kind of like the pension plan was the beer that you'd get.
So you tried this. What did it taste like?
It was kind of weedy, you know, a little bit like a flat Miller, because it wasn't carbonated. So not terrible as long as you're able to stomach Miller.
I want to talk about another aspect of this trash talk. This is something, obviously, which is flourishing. It's alive and well on the internet and lots of other places, sports courts all over the world. Why is trash talk something that would have been ultimately good for us and helped us thrive as a species?
Well, it helped us create the very basis of language. There's something called what linguists call an exogenic V compound, or the merge, which is when you stick two words together. Like, you know, trash talker, for example, would be one example of that. Daredevil, killjoy. You can think of a few that are more obscene. And these are considered to be one of the earliest stages of the evolution of human language. That's one of the first things people start doing. First, they come up with, you know, single terms to refer to things in their world, and then they start mashing those terms together, and it broadens essentially the base of their communication. And these merged exogenic VN compounds are almost exclusively used as insults. And one of the theories behind why that might be is that when young men have the ability to insult each other in a very elaborate and lengthy way, they're less likely to fight. Like, it gives them something to do besides physically grapple with each other, which means less men are wounding and killing each other in displays of, you know, masculinity. Instead, they're able to, you know, get that same competitive urge out, but do it without, or at least with lower odds of engaging in violence. And so that's one theory as to why trash talking is such a central part of the evolution of human language.
That's interesting, because you could think that could just escalate the whole situation and make everything more volatile, but you're saying it actually just diffused it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, we all know cases of times when trash talking turned into violence, but having the option to talk, you know, is why, like, that gives us a much broader variety of ways to get into conflict with each other without fighting each other. You know, just look at cable news.
I want to move on now and look at another aspect that you studied. You looked at drugs and how some very influential thinkers used them through the years, and sometimes it sounds like to good effect for civilization. What did you find, especially about, let's start with the ancient Greeks?
Well, the ancient Greeks had a drug that's called kaikeion, and it's most likely, no one's quite sure exactly what it was, but the most likely theory is that they were extracting a chemical called LSA, which is, you know, as you can probably guess, pretty closely related to LSD and very hallucinogenic. And this was the mysteries that they took part in, which was a 9-day fast of some extent, followed by a hike and essentially a drug trip with all of the men involved in this cult, were partaken in by basically every Greek philosopher you could care to name, any political figure of the time, you know, Socrates, Xenophon. They all engaged in these mysteries and took this drug together. And it was considered to be quite a transformative experience. And there's no way to tell exactly what impact it would have had, but Plato wrote pretty extensively about the Eleusinian mysteries and his Kaikeion trips, and seemed to credit Socrates with having done the same. And those are two guys to whom, you know, Western civilization owes a significant intellectual debt. For a more concrete example of drugs influencing a discovery, we can look to modern genetic science. Francis Watson, who is the guy credited with being one of the people credited with figuring out the helical, double helix structure of DNA. He says it came to him during an acid trip. And I think more significantly, Kerry Mullis, who's another genetic scientist, came up with the what's called the polymerase chain reaction, which is essentially a type of genetic technology that is kind of the basis of our ability to track blood to an individual from a crime scene, to identify, you know, someone who might have a genetic illness that's going to affect them later in life. The PCR is sort of the building block of all of that science. And he to this day, decades later, credits the discovery to an acid trip he had. It's not empty, the annals of history, stories of people crediting significant developments to their substance use. And I think there's a good reason. You know, studies significantly show or consistently show that people with higher IQs seek out and experiment with all forms of things more often, but particularly hallucinogenic substances.
Do you think that we've sanitized our history to the point where we're missing out on some of the major contributors to the things we think of as building blocks of civilization, some of the pillars of civilization?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just think about alcohol. As I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons people survived back in the day is because they had alcohol to clean their water. If you're drinking watered-down wine, you're drinking water that's been turned into beer, that water is not going to have the same kind of microbes that might kill you that, you know, water just out in the world that could be stagnant can have, which is a big reason why beer drinking and wine drinking was so common in the cities of the ancient world. It kept disease at bay. But that also meant that pretty much everyone was a little bit drunk for most of history. You look at Alexander the Great, who had an enormous impact on the evolution of our species, you know, conquered the greatest empire of the ancient world, was drunk the entire time, and it absolutely impacted his decisions. He burned down the largest city on the planet because he got drunk and angry. Who knows the impact that's had on history. I'm not saying that, you know, vice is always a positive or a negative impact, but the story of Alexander the Great that I got in high school sanitized all that out, like it's sanitized.
And we leave it there. Robert, thank you so much for joining us. That was Robert Evans. He's the author of A Brief History of Vice. Coming up after the news, being hard on yourself is part of life. We'll learn why being kind to yourself can have bigger benefits. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk to a Wisconsin sheriff about a nationwide effort to stop drunk driving. First, when we screw up and we fail, most people have a tendency to dwell on their mistakes. And as humans, we tend to think negatively in many aspects of our lives, ranging from regrets to high expectations. But new research shows that we actually could benefit from a little kindness from ourselves. And learning to be kind to ourselves can have a remarkable effect on our happiness. Joining us now to talk about this is Mark Leary. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and he recently wrote an article for the online magazine Eon called Don't Beat Yourself Up. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, your piece about being kind to yourself, you start off by saying that humans are really the only animal that specializes in making themselves miserable. What do we know about why that is?
Well, human beings are the only animals that can think consciously about themselves. And so we can think about ourselves in negative ways. We can look into the future and begin to dread and worry about what's happening in ways that other animals can't. They react to the bad events that happen right in the moment. But as long as they're safe in their burrows, they're not lying there awake all night long the way that we are, tossing and turning in bed, worrying about the next day.
And why do people dwell on their mistakes?
Well, we really don't know, but we think it's probably because when you make a mistake, it's probably better to assume in one way that it's more serious than it really is. That is, it's better to take something very seriously than to overlook the possibility that you did something very negative or very badly and aren't paying attention to it. So we seem to have a built-in bias to be harder on ourselves than we really need to be, than we really need to be from a realistic sense. Things are usually not as bad as we think they are.
Mark Leary is with us right now. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we're talking about why research shows that being kind to ourselves is actually a lot more beneficial than being tough on ourselves. It has a good effect on our happiness and our sense of well-being. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you find it difficult to be kind to yourself? Or maybe you've been working on being kind to yourself and you've got some advice for the rest of us. Tell us what you've learned and how it works. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is it like when you're kind to yourself? 800-642-1234. Do you think there's anything that's maybe uniquely American about being hard on ourselves? Do Americans like to beat themselves up when things go badly? And why is that? Is it possible to turn this equation around? There is research out there showing that, yeah, we can be happier, we can be healthier, we can have a better sense of well-being if we'd only learn how to be kind. And interesting stuff there, too. When we're kind to ourselves, we process it as though a friend is being kind to us. We get that same level of benefit with that friendship. So let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. And we're working on getting Mark Leary back with us, again, professor of psychology at Duke University. And we'll see if he's back with us. Mark, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you pretty well. A little soft, but I think our listeners will be able to catch what you're saying there. And Mark, tell us about some of this research about why these days it seems like focusing on kindness to ourselves is supplanting what we used to think about having positive self-esteem.
Well, for many years, we believed that self-esteem was really important, which it is. People want to feel good about themselves and evaluate themselves positively. But it's much more important to treat yourself kindly and compassionately, the way you would treat a loved one. The irony is, most of us are far meaner to ourselves in our own minds than we would ever be toward people that we care about. And it's just interesting to think about dealing with yourself the same way that you would deal with other people when they have problems, to reduce the blame and the criticism and the negativity. And if you do that, it produces the same kind of positive effects it produces on loved ones when we show them compassion.
Can we be specific about what it means to be kind to ourselves? I think I know what that means, but if I'm actually in that moment, what am I doing to be kind to myself?
You're simply being supportive. It's not positive thinking. It's not just saying everything is okay, you're a wonderful person, don't worry about anything. That's usually not what you say to loved ones who are having a problem. You're realistic with them. You talk about the problem as it really exists, but you don't let them exaggerate it. You don't let them catastrophize and turn it into something worse than it really is. The problems of life are bad enough as they are. And it's somewhat ironic that we beat ourselves up and make ourselves feel even worse about what's happened to us than we would have felt by the event itself happening. So it's just a matter of being compassionate and caring and kindness to yourself without minimizing the problems that you may have, because they really are there.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Zane joining us in Madison. Zane, hi.
Hello. It's great to be on there. I love this show. It's super great when you do all these like positive, uplifting moments.
Oh, thank you.
But this last summer, I've been going through basically what this your guest has been talking about. Is I just went super down on myself. I was in a company that felt like they were constantly putting me down. And I personally felt like I was taking all this blame and that I was kind of the cause of every issue going on. But they really loved me. Like, any time I brought up, oh, I feel like I'm being underappreciated, they would say, no, you're working really hard. There are some issues, but you are really valued. And it took me a long time this summer to just realize that everyone kind of sees you with your strengths, and you always see yourself as so weak. But it really helps to kind of just, even though there might be bad issues or bad problems, that you have strength, you are a good person, and that you can get through it eventually.
And so, Zane, do you feel like that made a difference in your sense of well-being and happiness when you were able to be nicer to yourself?
Oh, it's mind-opening when you realize, like, okay, I'm strong enough to get through whatever comes my way, basically, that you can always get away. There's always a new way around a different problem. Like, roadblocks always come up, but there's always a over, under, left, or right around the situation.
Great. Well, Zane, thank you so much, and thanks for the kind words about Central Time. And Mark, one takeaway from that call is that Zane was able to change his thinking. He was able to be kind to himself. Is that one of the strengths of this approach, is that it's not too hard to do, to learn to be kind to ourselves?
At the most basic level, it's not too hard. And as I listen to Zane talk, it's exactly the kind of thing he would have said to a good friend who was having those same kinds of problems at work. He simply said them to himself. And when you think of it that way, it's not really that hard. Once you realize you don't have to beat yourself up. That was the turning point for me. It's like a light bulb went off, and I realized I don't have to be as negative toward myself as I have been my whole life. Should you get down on yourself now and then and be critical? Of course. Should you feel badly when you do bad things? Of course. The question is, how badly should you feel? And Zane's learned that he didn't have to feel as badly as he was making himself feel previously.
What do we know about why this is better than focusing on self-esteem? Because that used to be the big thing, as you write about. It used to be there was even, you know, government money going toward increasing people's self-esteem. So why didn't that work as well as this works?
Because once you feel badly about yourself and you have low self-esteem, it's very hard to prop that up artificially. If you really negatively evaluate yourself, it takes a lot of work to evaluate yourself more positively. It's much easier to be kind to yourself, because you can be kind to yourself even if you don't like yourself very much. Even if your self-esteem is low, you can treat yourself well and treat yourself with caring and concern, just like you can treat other people you don't like very well. You don't have to like them and hold them in high esteem. You can still treat them with compassion and caring and kindness, and you can do the same thing for yourself. So self-compassion or self-kindness is more applicable for everybody, because you don't have to start out at a point where you're already feeling good about yourself.
Are we basically talking about self-talk here? So if I've screwed up and I feel bad, I made a bad decision, is it basically the way that I talk to myself, or is it things like treating myself? I'm going to let myself go to bed early and I'm going to have a cup of tea. Which is it? Is it talk or actionable stuff?
I would say it's both. And if you think about how we treat other people who are going through a hard time, we'll say things to them. We'll talk to them in a way that's kind and caring. But we also might suggest we'll go to bed earlier, or let's go out and get a drink and talk about this, or treat yourself to ice cream today. So it's both the way we talk to ourselves in our own mind, and it's the nice things we do to ourselves. This really came out with a student I was working with who had come back from a visit with her grandparents. And they were getting elderly, they were forgetting things, they weren't able to get around as they could. And her grandfather beat himself up awful. He just agonized over not being able to do what he used to do. But her grandmother just naturally had self-compassion. And she would say things like, when I get up and I realize that it's going to be a rough day for me with my arthritis, I treat myself special that day. I take better care of myself, which is exactly, again, what you would do for a friend. You wouldn't just scream at your friend for not forgetting where the car keys are or not being able to walk across the room in a steady way. So it's talk and action.
Let's take another call now. We've got Paul on the line with us from Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thank you for the guest. I wanted to say that I've recently gone through a pretty difficult time, and discovering that I have the choice to be kind to myself has been very beneficial. I came about that discovery through some literature, Mindfulness for Beginners and the Four Agreements. And I'd like to get your guest's opinion on mindfulness and the correlation that it has with his literature.
Thank you, Paul, for that question. Is there a correlation between mindfulness, a sort of meditation, and being kind to yourself?
Absolutely, because people who practice mindfulness quiet down a lot of this internal chatter that is often very unkind to us. And in fact, the researcher who first started the study of self-compassion about 10 years ago, it's Dr. Kristen Neff at the University of Texas, explicitly connects self-compassion with the practice of mindfulness, and it's one way to get there. And she says that self-compassionate people are naturally more mindful. They're more attuned to their current situation without judgment and without a lot of self-talk. They just accept the moment as it is, and that's one route. There are other ways to be self-compassionate, but one way is just to accept what's here without a whole lot of internal commentary about it.
Mark Leary is with us now, and he's telling us about why learning to be kind to ourselves can have remarkable benefits, according to science. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and we want to hear from you on this. Do you find that it's kind of hard to be kind to yourself, or is this something that, like some of our listeners here, you've been working on and you've seen maybe results? Tell us what your experience is. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll continue our conversation in just a bit. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation about how being kind to yourself can be beneficial to your physical and your mental well-being. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you find that being kind to yourself is difficult? If you are kind to yourself, was it a difficult transition to make that shift if you're someone who was used to kind of beating yourself up when you did make a mistake? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org. Mark Leary is with us. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we go to our callers now. Katie is first in Madison. Hi, Katie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My first thought when you began the show was, I'm 63, and so I was brought up at a time when at home and in school where it was thought that if you did something wrong, raking you over the coals was the correct action to make you feel horrible so you wouldn't do it again. And, as I've grown over the years and had to evolve from that, I do remember having to make that transition from thinking how stupid I was every time I did something wrong and, going into it's not so bad. So, I have this little dialogue going in my head. And now I kind of amuse myself sometimes because I as I'm going through something, I'm thinking of, oh, well, I could be reacting to, this thing that I did and telling myself what an idiot I am. But I'm not, because I realize at my age, it's not the end of the world to make a mistake. I'm going to make a lot of mistakes, and that's okay, and, life will go on. But, my father, I had this talk with him about when I was, as an adult, about that behavior of, screaming at us and saying how terrible we were to make a mistake. And he said that he was brought up in a German household where they thought that brought about excellence.
Interesting, Katie. Yeah, so that's a great point Katie just brought up there. First of all, that's great, Katie, that you were able to make that shift all on your own and figure out how to be kind to yourself. And Mark, is there something to that, that it used to be sort of where the cultural norm that was how you learned your lessons? You made yourself suffer and feel bad about it. And if you didn't do that, you weren't going to learn the lesson.
Absolutely. And there are plenty of people today who still subscribe to that idea. And I think it's because we're afraid that we're not going to act the way we should. We're going to misbehave, or our kids are going to misbehave, unless we really come down on them extremely hard. And, of course, people have to be corrected. There's nothing wrong with parents getting on their kids for misbehaving or even making mistakes. The question is, how harsh do you need to be on other people, and how harsh do you need to be for yourself? We did a study a few years ago trying to understand people who actively resist the idea that you should be self-compassionate. Because as I've talked about this over the years, some people say, no, I don't think you should be nice to yourself. You need to come down hard on yourself. You need to be stoic and really set the highest standards. But there's nothing incompatible with having really high standards, but yet finding that sweet spot of how badly do I need to feel in order to keep me on track. And my sense is that most of us go overboard. We assume we have to be much harder on ourselves than we really do, and we can still keep ourselves in line and achieve and do excellent things and be moral people with a lot less chastisement of ourselves, a lot less self-denigration.
Now, in your piece, you talk about how there are both physical and mental and other markers of well-being that are associated with being kind to ourselves. what is the science out there? What can you point to that says, you know, look, here's someone who is healthier and happier because they're practicing this?
Well, in terms of emotion, every study that's been done on self-compassion, and there are dozens now, show that people who are more self-compassionate are happier, they're more satisfied with their lives, they have less anxiety, less depression, less negative emotions in general, they cope better with situations that arise. And I think for most of us, that's what we would like to have in life. We'd like to have a more contented life where everything wasn't such a tragedy and big deal. Bad things are going to happen, to be sure. But if we stop layering on extra self-recrimination and negative emotion, then life will seem better. Physically, there's evidence that anytime you reduce negative emotion and stress, it's better for the body. I mean, there's no question about that. So if you go through life beating yourselves up and upset with yourself chronically, you're going to have worse health than someone who takes things more in stride and has a little more equanimity.
Now, you were participating, you were working with a group of HIV patients and this idea of self-compassion, and there were some pretty striking differences in these patients and how they worked with themselves. What did you find?
We found not only that the people who were HIV positive, who were more self-compassionate, were coping better with having such a potentially dangerous disease, and they were coping better because they weren't adding, again, those extra layers of shame and self-criticism on top of the fact that they had an illness. But it also seemed to alleviate their concerns about talking about it with other people. So the individuals who were higher in self-compassion talked about being HIV positive more openly with their healthcare providers. They let other people know, because that sense of stigma and shame and self-recrimination just wasn't as high.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Ryan on the line with us in Watertown. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
So I've been dealing with this probably since like early 90s. It's just something that you kind of grow up. Like, some people can get through it by learning to be happier, the positive attitude kind of aspect of it. But, you know, I don't know, growing up in my household, it's more like a one-strike system where you do one bad thing because you want to please people, and then after you do something wrong, you really get down on yourself, and then it just keeps getting worse and worse. And now that I'm in my almost 30s, the attitude or trying to fight these thoughts, if you will, are harder to break. But one of my therapists has really helped me recently with this system that seemed almost childish to me, but it really works.
Can you tell us just briefly what that is?
Yeah. So what it basically is whenever I have a negative thought or start getting down myself, I'll write these like four categories, or these four squares, if you will. Kind of the first off with the negative feeling that I'm having, and then there's different categories of what attitude it is or what negative feeling it pertains to. And then also in the third one, kind of defend those positive or try to fight back the negative thoughts with what I did good or what, you know, what could have happened, but I did good kind of thing.
Ryan, thank you so much for sharing that. And so Ryan, he said these patterns of being tough on himself and having other people be tough on him were really hard to break. But with some therapy, it sounds like some specific techniques, he was able to learn this habit. How hard is it to pick up this habit once you've sort of learned the other one, Mark?
It's a challenge, I can say just personally, to make that sort of switch. The key thing is awareness. And what he really expressed there is being aware and attentive to the times in which you are being harsher on yourself, meaner to yourself than you would be on other people. And just to be alert to that fact and then to stop yourself and say, I wouldn't treat someone else this way. Why would I treat myself this way? Someone once said that if we treated other people the way we treat ourselves in our own heads, that we would be arrested for assault because we are sometimes so negative to ourselves in our heads. It's awareness and monitoring and keeping track of how we're talking to ourselves.
Now, just briefly, we're just about out of time, but I realize you're the researcher here. Have you tried this yourself?
I have struggled with being self-critical my whole life, and I was proud of it. I think a lot of people who are self-critical are proud of, I hold myself to high standards. But when you realize that you're making yourself miserable, then you realize it's not so cool anymore, and you decide, I don't have to be that harsh. I can still have high standards and be a good person without beating myself up.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Mark Leary. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and he joined us there to talk about how being kind to yourself, science says this, can have a positive effect on your happiness and on your health. Instead of self-esteem, be kind to yourself. That's according to the latest research on the science of positivity. Well, we haven't even hit Labor Day weekend yet, but football season is already here in Wisconsin. The Packers are in preseason training, and they've been out there honoring the well-loved Packer tradition of riding kids' bikes down Dream Lane into practice. And today, fans went a little nuts when wide receiver Jordy Nelson showed up after a bat injury. He was out, and he was in there today, caught his first pass from quarterback Aaron Rodgers. Also, Packer rookie Trevor Davis is now officially a Wisconsinite. The wide receiver is from California, but he recently tweeted about cheese curds. He said, I never knew what they were before, but now that I do, I'm in love. And he's right, here in Wisconsin, the way to our heart is definitely through our cheese. So yeah, there are some downsides about letting go of summer, going back to school. But for Packer fans, there is one shining green and gold reason to love the fall. Welcome back, Pack. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Stay tuned. There's more to come.